This afternoon, we talk about the impacts of integration of students with disabilities into the public education system. And we have three eminent persons to present. They are Celine Almazan, who is legal director of the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, Wanda Blanchett, who is dean and distinguished professor at Rutgers Graduate School of Education, and Ruth Kolker, distinguished university professor and Heck Faust Memorial Chair in Constitutional Law, Moritz College of Law, Ohio State University. Now, we have an interesting experiment today because two of these people are going to be making their presentation by technological means rather than being in person in the room. So we'll see how well that works. And as I understand it, Wanda Blanchett begins this presentation. Yes, Wanda?
That's correct.
Okay, so let's start with Wanda Blanchett.
Well, thank you all so very much. I certainly would have preferred to have been present with you, but due to our fourth Northeaster in 4 weeks, I'm sitting talking to you from the comforts of my office at Rutgers. I would first of all like to just thank Luann for her tremendous efforts in keeping us in the loop as we have been dealing with the inclement weather. So the title of this session today is the impacts of integration of students with disabilities into the public education system. I'm going to start because much of my work takes a historical look at the treatment of students of color as well as students with disabilities. And I think that you already know that there are significant parallels between the educational experiences of students of color as well as students with disabilities. And then, of course, there are various points at which these students intersect in terms of their being members of both groups. So we're not talking about necessarily discrete categories here. So with regard to the historical treatment of students of color, given that many of you have a legal background in the audience, you would be familiar with the fact that up until Plessy versus Ferguson, schools were segregated. And certainly even following the decision in Plessy versus Ferguson, schools were still deemed to be legally segregated in the United States. And it was through the advocacy of a number of individuals over a long period of time that we were able to finally get to the historic Brown decision. And with that decision, for the first time, the court stated that it was illegal to continue the segregation of students, of African American and other students of color. Prior to that time, certainly we had white schools that were white only schools, and then we had primarily African American schools. And of course, the impetus for the Brown case was around the fact that the schools were deemed to be separate and unequal. I shudder to think of what would have happened had there been comparable educational opportunities available to students in the black only schools, but that certainly wasn't the case. And the conditions in which they were attending school were also really troubling. But there were also some very positive components to the black only schools. Namely, that included the teachers and educators that were committed to the students, many of whom often had terminal degrees, especially in subject matter areas, because many of them, although they held PhDs, were not able to hold professorial positions at universities. So the conditions prior to the litigation of the Brown decision are very important to where we are today, because it was with that decision that the courts indicated that we could no longer continue the practice that had deemed to be appropriate in the decision of Plassey versus Ferguson. Now, the other component that's very important is the fact that for many decades, and we were having a little conversation about this as we were waiting to be hooked in to the technology, but the where we are today is the result of many decades of advocacy on the part of primarily parents and mothers concerned about the educational experiences that their children were not receiving in public education, whether that be African-American mothers and concerned community members, or whether that be parents of children with disabilities and concerned citizens. A lot of their advocacy resulted in our current privileges that we now enjoy, although we still don't necessarily have equity with regard to the enjoyment of those privileges. So shortly after the Brown decision in 1954, parents and other advocates determined that the timing was really right for them to capitalize upon the decision in the historic Brown case. And that's when we started to see the disability rights movement in terms of the pursuit of a free and appropriate public education for all children really take hold in terms of being able to litigate around the concerns that parents had about the fact that their children were not guaranteed a free and appropriate public education, and that the fact that we still had at that time many segregated institutions. It was common practice for individuals with disabilities to be segregated. We had a variety of different ways of engaging in that segregation. So we had our schools for the blind. We had our human development centers in every state. Some states had multiple facilities that were state and federally funded to segregate individuals with disabilities. But thankfully, we were able to get past, we were able to get the passage of the Handicapped Children, All Handicapped Children's Act of 1975, which was the first time that we actually had legally protected rights of every child with a disability to a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. But shortly after that, we started to notice some other trends. And I apologize if you can hear trains coming through. Our campus is not far from the train station. The train is either going to New York or it's headed towards Philadelphia. But at any rate, there were some other practices shortly after we saw. So I want to connect two things very clearly. So Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954 was the first time that we had equal protection under the law for students of color, namely African-American students and other students of color at the time. And then with the passage of the All Handicapped Children Act of 1975 was the first time that we had equal protection under the law for students with disabilities, regardless of the disability, as long as it was covered under the broad spectrum of the law. But one of the things that we started to notice was that even though Brown had been passed in 1954, schools were still, by and large, throughout the South and in some other areas, were still pretty much segregated. And in part, they were still segregated because there was resistance to the integration of schools. So we saw a number of other initiatives that had to be mitigated to go back into the courts and get desegregation laws on the desegregation orders in order for school districts to try to move them to where they needed to be with integration. So there was lots of resistance, is what I'm getting to. The other thing that we noticed, though, was that in New York City and in California, we started to notice in New York City, Lloyd Dunn pointed out in 1968 that he saw where Mexican-American students were being, African-American students were being placed in special education in New York City at rates that really exceeded their proportion in the general school population. So he raised the question about whether or not it was justifiable that so many African-American students were being placed in special education when they had for supposedly the what we now term high incidence disabilities. And he called attention to the fact that they were placed in the most significant disability categories, despite the fact that their white peers demonstrated far more visible disabilities. And at the same time, Jane Mercer started to notice, I say at the same, talking general same time period, 1973, Jane Mercer started to notice some similar patterns of behavior in terms of Mexican American students being placed in special education in, you know, categories for, at that time, profound mental retardation, trainable mental retardation, were the old terminology that, thank God, we have moved on beyond. So the two of them started to see these patterns. Well, what I've been able to do in my work is to illustrate that these patterns were not a coincidence. They were deliberate efforts to resist integration. And then even when students of color have legitimate disabilities for which they are entitled to services under what is now IDEA, we noticed that their treatment was very different. So even though, and I'm covering many years of history here quickly, don't take it lightly that there were a lot of things that happened in between, and I'm just giving a brief overview. But we started to notice that even though we had another movement towards more inclusive education, and it was certainly the right thing for us to do as a country, and it's the right thing for us to keep working to try to get right, we have noticed that even though many students with disabilities now, well over 60% of students with disabilities that are educated in PK-12 schools today are spending the overwhelming majority of their day in the general education classroom. And that's really great news. But what we have noticed is that it's not true for students of color. Students of color are still the ones that are most likely to be educated in separate schools and or facilities and or to spend the overwhelming majority of their day in a self-contained classroom. So this is just a brief overview of where we have been as a society. And certainly we have much work left to be done. I want to be respectful of my time, so I will stop there, but I'm happy to continue the dialogue, and we have set aside some time to do that.
Very good. Thank you very much. And now we hear from Professor Ruth Kolker.
Well, thank you, and let me also thank Luann for her amazing efforts to get this going when some of us couldn't even make it to Baltimore. So thank you for everyone's patience, and I hope that you can hear me well today. Well, I love the remarks that Wendy started us off with. They're so important. In Ohio, there was a recent study done by members of our education department that very much showed those very high rates of racial segregation in Ohio and the fact that Black students and white students are getting very different educational opportunities when they're in special education. The segregated facilities tend to be the worst and where parents would prefer not to send their children if they had any kind of choice. So I hope you really take to heart what Wendy had to say to start us off. Those are really important observations. I was asked today to please speak about the Indro F case and how it might affect the movement towards a more integrated education for students with disabilities. So I'm going to talk about that. Unfortunately, I don't really have a lot of good news to report, but I think it's important for us all to be well educated on these subjects, to think about what that means at the local level if we are doing advocacy for these students. As many of you are probably familiar with the Andrew F. case, but very briefly, the case involved a young child with autism whose parents had chosen to send him to the Firefly Autism House because the public school was allegedly doing such a poor job of educating him. And the issue in the case, there were a number of issues in the case, but the case was about whether the parents could get reimbursement for the tuition at the private school that they had chosen to send him to when the public school was not providing him with FAPE. And so the court had to decide what standard do we apply in deciding whether this young boy was receiving a free and appropriate public education. And there was a split in the circuits at the time as to how high that standard should be and whether any possible improvement should be enough or whether we should hold the school district to a higher standard. And so the question was, what does Rawling mean? What is the standard for a free, appropriate public education? And getting to the punchline, the Supreme Court ruled in Andrew F. that the IDEA requires an educational program reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances. And although that doesn't sound like the highest standard we can imagine, that was the better choice available to the court at that time, that it did insist that there be educational progress, that progress should be appropriate in light of the child's circumstances. So Andrew F. was considered to be a victory, a modest victory for the disability rights community, given the choices available to the court. But the question for us today is, and what does that have to do with integration? The court in Andrew F. Said that the IDEA sets high standards for students who are fully integrated. It made it clear that we need to have equivalently high standards for students who are not in a fully integrated environment. And it said the goals may differ, but every child should have the chance to meet challenging objectives. It also recited the standard statement from Rawling that children should be educated in the regular classroom, quote, whenever possible. And so some members of the disability rights community have said that it's great that in Andrew F., the court in two different places emphasized that children should be in the regular classroom, quote, whenever possible, that we should expect students to be fully integrated in the regular classroom as sort of the default principle. And it mentioned that the act prefers that children be educated in the regular classroom. So that's all good news in terms of the court understanding the importance of an integrated education to students with disabilities. So why do I think that this case, though, is not as important to the integration mandate as one might hope? And the reason I think this case is somewhat less important than people might otherwise think is that in Andrew F., like most of the cases that make it to the Supreme Court and most of the appellate cases under the IDEA, the legal question is whether the parents should get reimbursement for sending their child to a private educational environment. The parents are so distraught with the education available in the public school that they spend money out of their own pocket to send their child to a private educational environment rather than the public school. Those private schools the parents choose in those circumstances are almost always disability segregated. I don't know for a fact that that Andrew F. was going to a segregated facility, but it was called the Firefly Autism House. And I would bet that the Firefly Autism House is full of children with autism. Now, I'm not here to say that those parents made the wrong decision. I've never met Andrew F., I've never met these parents, I've never had a conversation with them. So that's not my point, whether those parents made the right decision for their child. The point is that this case is not about the question of whether the public school was offering Andrew F. the most integrated environment possible. This case is a situation where the parents opt out of the public school and send their child to a private school that has to be more segregated than any educational environment that the public school was probably offering them. And in fact, in the record, there's discussion of the fact that the district had been sending Andrew F., had been having Andrew F. spend more and more time not in the general education classroom, as under the assumption that he had previously been in the general education classroom. So this case is a case about a situation where most likely the child was attending a more segregated environment as a result of this litigation rather than a more integrated environment. So when you read special education cases as I do, one of the things I think you should always keep in mind in thinking about these cases is, where is this child being educated? What have the parents asked for? And you will see that in many, many, many of these cases, what the parent has requested is actually to put their child in a more segregated environment. That puts us in an interesting posture as advocates. You know, how do we want to talk with parents? Do we want to ask parents to rethink that decision? Or is that the right decision for their child, even if we think the default rule should be for a child to be in the most integrated environment possible? Okay, so that's the Andrew F. litigation. That's what actually happens in Andrew F. So what have the courts done with Andrew F. And I have tried to read all the post Andrew F. case law to get a sense of how the courts have been interpreting Andrew F. And what I want to emphasize is that although the disability rights community has often said that when we read Andrew F., we should note how the Supreme Court in three different passages mentions that the child should be in the regular education classroom whenever possible, so it understands the integration presumption. But it's also true that the Andrew F. case says, and I'll quote it again, the IDEA requires an educational program reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress in light of the child's circumstances. And what I have seen in the post-Andrew F. litigation is that that phrase, in light of the child's circumstances, is the phrase most often cited by district courts and courts of appeals in interpreting Andrew F. And they use the phrase in light of the child's circumstances often to say that it's okay for the child to be in a more segregated environment because that's really all that this child can possibly handle. And so if I was a school district lawyer, and I am not, but if I were, right, it's the in light of the child's circumstances clause that I would want to keep putting in the face of a court to say what we're doing is good enough. The Andrew F. case actually doesn't hold us to the highest standard. In reading the post-Andrew F. cases, I've sort of looked to see whether there have been any cases in which the integration presumption is emphasized, you know, wins out. I was able to find maybe two cases that somewhat have to do with that thesis. There's one case from Tennessee, IL versus Knox County Board of Education from 2017. It's a pretty troubling case, as these cases often are. It was a case involving a child with Down syndrome. The mother consistently took the position that her child should have no more than 20 minutes of special education a day. She really wanted her child to be in a fully integrated environment as much as possible. The school district got around that request, got around that rule in the IEP by having the child for 4 hours, I'm not sure exactly how long, for a significant period of time, maybe as long as 4 hours, sitting in essentially a mat in a hallway in a sort of restrained area, a very inhumane behavior, and without notifying the mother of this segregated situation for this child, totally in violation of the school district's policies on seclusion and restraint. And so when the mother found out about that, she pulled the kid from the public school and she litigates the school district not offering her child FAPE. The case settles, she gets a victory, although as often happens in these cases, she pulled her kid out of the public school and put her kid into a private school because she was not satisfied with the education the public school is offering. So it's an interesting case. The mother really wanted her child to be in an integrated environment. The school district acted in a horrific way to avoid that result. She wins. I don't know if she would really call it a victory because obviously her child was treated very poorly before this happened. And the child ends up going to a private school. I don't know that that private school was segregated on the basis of disability, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that it was. Another case that is also fairly recent is the CD versus Natick Public School District case from Massachusetts from July 2017. That's a situation where there's a dispute between the parents and the school district about the child's education, and the school district prevails by saying that they were the one offering the child the more integrated education. And this sometimes happens in these cases, that the school district says, oh, the private placement that the parent is seeking is actually not as good a placement because the placement that we're offering is the more integrated placement. So sometimes the integration mandate is a tool that the school district uses rather than the parent. So that's, I guess, the news that I have to offer, which is that these cases are really complicated. They often involve a tuition reimbursement where the parent is sending the child to a private school, where the parent actually doesn't want their child to be in a fully integrated education environment. And we don't always know the race of these parents, but I suspect that many of these parents are white middle-class parents who have the resources to put their child in a private school and then seek tuition reimbursement. It's hard to seek tuition reimbursement if you don't have money in your pocket to pay for the private school itself. And one of the big issues that I'm sure Wendy knows quite a bit about, she's written a lot about this, is that when we talk about segregated placements, not all segregated placements are the same. And the segregated placements that these white parents, white middle-class parents are often seeking on behalf of their children may in fact be good placements. But the segregated placements that we see poor and minority children being forced into, the ones that I see in my state of Ohio, are not good placements. They're not placements where parents would typically voluntarily place their child if they have any kinds of choices to be made. And I guess the question will be going forward, you know, can we use the Andrew F. case in any way to push courts to raise the standards for what we expect of school districts so that these really pitiful, awful segregated placements won't be foisted on poor and minority children. But I don't see any case law yet suggesting that we've reached that outcome. But I hope that our final speaker can offer us some good news on the subject. Thank you.
Which brings us to the presentation from the legal director of COPA. Here is Celine Almazan.
Thank you. And thank you for inviting us, COPA, to the symposium. This is our first time here, so I appreciate it. I've heard a lot about it through the years. So I'm going to start off my very first time at the symposium sort of disagreeing with Dr. Ruth Kolker, which will sort of make me a little nervous. So COPA worked on Andrew F., as did many others in this room, Bazelon. And the decision, I think, has wonderful language in it to put forth this idea that you are entitled to challenging and ambitious goals. And going back to what Wanda said at the very beginning, you know, we have this really rich history of marginalizing not only people because of disability, but also marginalizing because of race. And the Andrew F. decision challenges school districts to look at what the IDEA requires. It is a procedure-laden and substantive law that guarantees the rights, the civil rights of students with disabilities, and provides a roadmap on how to ensure that those civil rights are upheld. And from COPA's perspective, looking at that roadmap that the IDEA requires through the process of the Individualized Education Program, the IEP process, is really the key here. You know, Andrew's parents wanted that public school placement to work, but he had some behaviors that were related to his autism. And the school system failed to conduct a functional behavior assessment to look at what those behaviors were and the root cause of what those behaviors are. Failed to do that in order to keep him in a less restrictive setting. Once they went to Firefly, they came back and they said, we want to come back to our public school. And the school district gave them the same IEP and no offer of a functional behavior assessment and no offer of a behavior intervention plan, which are key components to keeping kids in general education classes. And so while Andrew F. doesn't discuss necessarily the general education classroom, and it is about a family that was seeking reimbursement, they were a family who went to Firefly only because it was the very last resort for them, and they had a kid who had been failing for a couple of years, and they didn't have any more time to waste. And I think that's what happens with families. They don't have any more time to waste, and the clock is ticking. So that's what they decided to do. And for them, they were very fortunate that the Supreme Court got it. It was a very, very low standard in the 10th Circuit. It's de minimis. Ruth is correct. The case law so far has not borne out what we were hoping it would bear out. A couple of us in this room were on a panel in the summertime and with Brian Wolfman, one of the attorneys for Andrew. And we talked a little bit about, it's really those cases that we're developing now that are so important, utilizing this standard. So utilizing this standard, ensuring that school districts give students challenging and ambitious goals to not make assumptions on what a child can do based on what their disability is, but based upon what they can demonstrate that they can do. So that's my take on Andrew for right now. It is a work in progress. COPA and Bazelon have been filing amicus briefs in least restrictive environment cases throughout the country, trying to advance this idea that there is an application of challenging and ambitious goals, the roadmap of the IEP, the obligations of the IEP team, the obligation, like in Andrew, when there was no progress on behavior, to go back to an IEP team table and look at progress. That's what COPA calls course correction. It's incumbent upon school teams to reconvene and see what is working and what is not working to prevent parents from becoming so frustrated that they decide to look at something else. So that's my take on Andrew. You know, there's also some language that school systems have to provide cogent and responsive reasons for what they do at an IEP team table, and we need to hold school systems accountable. What is a cogent reason? What is a responsive reason that you're making these decisions? And so I think that there's a lot to look at in the decision and a lot in the IEP process in the IDEA. The statute is a beautiful thing. And so are the regulations. It is full of so many rights and so many things to argue at an IEP team table and at a hearing. So that's my two cents on the Andrew F. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the research the COPA has been doing for the National Council on Disability. We recently completed a 5-report series for NCD, and the 5 topics were the segregation of students with disabilities, English learners and low-income students, the Every Student Succeeds Act, the underfunding of the IDEA, and monitoring and compliance. And briefly, I wanted to talk a little bit about the statistics. I know that Wanda touched on them, but some of the things that we found in our study is that there remains a very large gap, depending on where you live, on your zip code, on whether or not you're getting access to general education classrooms if you're a child with a disability, and that's unfortunate. The data for the 2015-2016 school years show that Alabama, Vermont, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Kentucky have the highest rates of including kids with disabilities in the general education classrooms. The ones with the lowest, the states with the lowest averages, the average for the entire country, including the islands and Guam and Samoa and the Virgin Islands, is about 68%. So you're looking at places like Florida at 72%, you're looking at Alabama at 84%, Nebraska at 76%. So you're living there, you have a disability, chances are you're going to get access to a general education classroom. Compared to New Jersey, Montana, Illinois, and Arkansas, where there is a real struggle to get access. And these states, Hawaii is at 37%. Montana is at 47%. We also discovered in our research that students with intellectual disabilities and multiple disabilities participate in general education classes at 17% and at 13%. So it's 17% of students with an intellectual disability participate in a general education classroom, which is really astounding. The really alarming part of that data is that if you look at data from 2005 to 2015, those numbers have not moved that much in 10 years. So there's still a lot of work to be done, a lot of bias if you have a child with an intellectual disability diagnosis or if you have a child with the multiple disabilities. There's no presumption of competence, unfortunately. Wanda did talk about the disproportionality or the discrepancy, and white students and Native American students are included in general education classes at far higher rates than students who are African American. One of the other things that we looked at in the segregation report is Florida has a high rate of children with disabilities who are participating in general education classes at 72%. They have a state statute that defines inclusion, which is really kind of interesting. So there is a definition that is in their state statute that school teams have to look at, and the hypothesis of obviously is that that drives the greater placement into general education classes. Now, New Jersey, conversely, has a settlement agreement brought about by litigation, disability rights advocates in New Jersey. But no state policy ever changed once the settlement agreement came into being. So no policies changed, no statutes changed. And in fact, what remains in New Jersey is a state code that talks about ratios. 3 to 1 for an autism class, 5 to 1, I'm making these numbers up, but you get the idea that they have a code that talks about ratios. And so it would seem to me that that would encourage placement based on grouping rather than on individualization. And individualization is at the core of the IDEA and the IEP. There has never been a federal withholding of money for failing to comply with the least restrictive environment mandate. The Office of Special Education Programs, since at least 1994, have issued Dear Colleague letters and guidance on LRE. Most recently, in January of 2017, there was a Dear Colleague letter that was issued talking about ensuring access to high-quality early education childhood programs. The reports, which are online at the NCD website, have a lot of research, and there is a ton of research based on 30 years or more of research on the benefits of inclusive placements or placement in general education for children with disabilities and children without disabilities. Some of the recommendations that we talked about are really good teaching practices and things that, as advocates, I think are important for us to ask questions about the delivery of instruction. I mean, that's the very definition of specialized instruction. The very definition of special education is specialized instruction, and specialized instruction is the content methodology or delivery of instruction. And so looking at supports for teachers, looking at differentiated instruction in classrooms, looking at data-based instructional decisions, looking at positive behavior intervention plans, peer-assisted learning, culturally responsive teaching, and multi-tiered systems of support, I think are all things to look at, and what the research shows are important for ensuring that general education placement is successful for students with disabilities. Our English learner report, we also looked at English learners and the nexus between being an EL student with a disability and also living in poverty. And 10% of the 6 million school-age students eligible for IDEA nationally are identified as English learners. And I didn't really realize until we did the report series how large that number was. And 58% of students that are eligible for special education are from low-income houses, compared to 46% of non-IDEA students. And so that's a statistic that I'm sure everybody is aware of, that most children with disabilities live in poverty in this country. Looking at the effects on disproportionality, we found that students with a specific learning disability and a hearing impairment have higher proportions of students who are also classified as English learners. We also found that students from low-income families were considerably more likely to be identified for special education, and that English learners and low-income students with disabilities are both disproportionately placed in substantially separate classrooms. And the rate of placement in substantially separate classrooms for low-income students was more than double the placement in substantially separate classrooms for non-low-income students. It all comes down, though, to looking at the family engagement and family education for people who are new to this country and are trying to navigate our system. And then finally, the third report that we did on the Every Student Succeeds Act, which took effect in 2017 school year, It includes several very specific provisions that require states to hold students with disabilities to the same high academic standards as all other students and include those students in state accountability systems. That's so important because it's really a presumption of competence. It's really holding school systems responsible for the education of children with disabilities. And assure that students with the most significant cognitive disabilities and their families understand the impact of choosing alternate standards, the alternate assessment standards, and assessments on that student's access to the general curriculum and to a regular high school diploma. So before the students are placed on the alternative assessment track and taken off of the diploma track, make sure that families understand the effect of that. The ESSA requires school districts now to improve school conditions by reducing the incidences of bullying and harassment and the overuse of discipline practices that remove students from the classroom through suspensions and expulsions, and the use of aversive behavioral interventions, which is restraint seclusion, which is very important and one of COPA's policy priorities. So, that's kind of the overview of some of the research that we've done in looking at the impact of having a disability, being a student with an intellectual disability, being a student that might be an English learner and live in poverty, and the access is still varied depending on where you're from, depending on where you live. And there's still a lot of work to be done. However, I do think that the IDEA does contain that roadmap. I think that Andrew F. provides us with some additional tools that we can use to require school districts to do what they need to be, what they've always been required to do, which is to implement it in an individualized fashion. So thank you.
Thank you very much to all three of you. Do the panel members have questions for each other?
Could I make a little response to the disagreement with me?
Well, it's always good to do that.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I don't think we really disagree. I mean, I absolutely agree that the parents and Andrew F., as I said, were upset that their son was being educated more and more outside the general education classroom in the program the district was providing him. And obviously they were very critical of the program the district was providing. That's why they were litigating. But still the factually that the way those cases are structured is that the parent, as a last resort, I would completely agree with that characterization, send a child to a private school, and then the relief that the court is offering is reimbursement for that private education, not reintegration into the public school setting. And I think that's unfortunate. It may very well be that that's what the parents ultimately would like, and maybe someday Andrew F. will be able to return to the regular public school classroom. I hope that's the case. But those are the stories that these cases tell, and it's the same frustrating story in the Knox County case I mentioned. That mother could not have been more adamant that she wanted her son with Down syndrome to be educated in the regular educational environment with no more than 20 minutes a day of special education. The school district completely thwarts what she's asking for. And then she's put in this untenable situation, which after her son's been exposed to seclusion and restraint, that she opts out to a private setting and again seeks tuition reimbursement. So I would never suggest that these parents are, as a first order, seeking this private education in a segregated environment. But it is what happens in these cases. And that's unfortunate that even when these parents prevail, that the end result is that these children are often in highly segregated environments. But the one other point I wanted to make, which I think we all would agree with, in terms of this Ohio study that I mentioned during my remarks, some people say build it and they will come. So if the school district in these urban areas in Ohio, that'd be Cleveland, Toledo, Cincinnati, Columbus, if they invest in these highly segregated placements, then they will place children there. Mm-hmm. And because of the composition racially of who lives in urban school district environments, that's gonna be disproportionately minority children. In Ohio, our studies show that in the rural communities, they don't have these segregated facilities. And so no one is placed there because they don't exist. And so yeah. I think one strategy for us to consider is, do we wanna be fighting at the local level as we have for residential placements. You know, we're not talking today about Olmsted and the like, but we have at previous conferences. This is an Olmsted problem. You build it and they will come. And so is that the best use of public resources to build these highly segregated private facility, not private, highly segregated disability only facilities, and then see them populated disproportionately with poor and minority children? Mm-hmm. So I don't know anything about the situation in New Jersey. Maybe Wanda could inform us about the explanation for the high rates of segregation you see there. But is that part of the pattern there with the highly urban school district environments? Are they building it and then they come, they get placed there?
Well, actually, I wanted to respond to a couple of things. First of all, I agree with you completely in terms of your characterization of what often occurs when parents do win a litigative action around the reimbursement for private schooling. First of all, I think the point that you made initially in your opening comments were right on the money, which is that, first of all, those options to have private school as an option for your child isn't afforded to all parents. And we know historically it isn't afforded to low-income parents across the board. So when it comes to low-income parents, we miss, and students, we miss no opportunity to discriminate, right? And certainly it's also not afforded to even middle-class and upper-class parents of color. So again, those options are not available to all. The other component that I would say, and I agree, and I think I work a lot with parent agencies and parent support initiatives. And I can tell you, we're all saying that parents ought to choose the option that's best for their child. But I also think that we have to be mindful of the fact that resegregation is resegregation, right? So even if the parents are doing, if they're choosing the lesser of the evils, if you will, for their child, we don't want resegregation to occur one child at a time. So we have to be very mindful of that. With regard to New Jersey, well, first of all, we don't have enough time to fully discuss some of the challenges that parents of color and parents of students with disabilities, and sometimes they are intersected. We don't have enough time to discuss the challenges that parents have experienced in ensuring that their children receive a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment in New Jersey. New Jersey has a long history of a number of litigative actions needing to take place for us to get to the quote unquote level of integration that we have today. So I suspect that the rates that you see are influenced by the fact that certainly in the urban cores of New Jersey, the overwhelming majority of the students are students of color, and the overwhelming majority of the students are children whose family live at or below the poverty line. And again, I mean, we didn't have time to go into all the details of some of this today, but we do know that there certainly are different educational options and different educational experiences that students experience in schools today. One thing that I'll mention before I stop, and that's the fact that when we take a look at today's schools, a lot of people like to say, oh, schools are more diverse than they've ever been. But when you really look at it, schools are not more diverse today than they've ever been. Schools are more segregated today than they've ever been. And I'll just stop there.
Okay, now, Celine says she can't help but explain also, so here she is.
You know, having been involved about 11, 12 years ago of fighting the building of a segregated school in a local county in Maryland, it was completely and absolutely bruising because it's an opportunity to pit one parent against another parent, and it is really not for the faint of heart. It's really very difficult. And then working as an attorney a couple of years later, again, assisting a local county to get rid of their self-contained classrooms because the disparity of the amount, the children of color in a self-contained classroom in one part of the county, and their academic acquisition, which was abysmal, compared to the upper middle class white county on the other side of the highway, and how they had, you know, taken their money, the parents' money through the PTA, and gotten all these wonderful things in these self-contained classrooms, and they wanted to hang on to that. Having been involved in that and having my children accosted in schools by teachers who were upset with what I was doing, I don't relish going back to that because it does pit parent against parent and makes things very difficult. It was so difficult for me, actually, that I could not even go to my gym because people were so angry over what they perceived were my actions. I don't have enough power to make a whole county make a decision, right? I wish I did. But, you know, galvanizing and organizing parents would have to include keeping people together. And there are people who, parents, for their own reasons, and I absolutely do not judge that. I have two children with disabilities. Make decisions for their children, and that's their decision that they make. But if we're going to talk to families about preventing the build, you know, if you build it, they will come. I agree with Ruth on that. We have to make sure that they stay together and nobody feels like they're being judged for the decisions that they make. And I think that's tricky as a community organizer, as an advocate, as a grassroots organizer. That's all I wanted to respond to. I just think that I agree with Ruth. I do, and I agree with what Wanda said, that we are headed into or have reached the point where our communities or our schools are not as diverse, and that includes not just class, color, socioeconomic, but it also includes disabilities, and absolutely, that's a shame.
Here's what I want to know. These two things. A few years ago, I run this meeting for blind people, has 3,000 people in it or so every year. I did it for 28 years. And a few years ago, I got my best advisors together and I said to them, I want an education program this summer. And I want the best education system in the country that deals with blindness that there is. Who is doing a good job? The silence then was the same as it is now. Nobody had an answer for me. So I want to know who's doing a good job, and I want to know what is a good job. The second thing I want to know is this. With the IEP process as it is, how do you get systemic change? You can't do it one kid at a time.
I'm sorry, but I didn't hear the first part of your question.
The first question is, who is doing a good job, and how do you know when it's a good job? What is a good job in the education system? Who can you point to and say, that is an example of where we want to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will start on that one, given that I'm in education. I think we have a number of examples of individual teachers that are doing a phenomenal job. Mm-hmm. We work in some of those schools here in and around our campus and throughout the state. So I think that they're teachers that are doing a very good job. My criticism is not of teachers. My criticism is of systemic issues and challenges and the infrastructures that teachers often work in that create havoc for them to do the things that they are trained to do well. My other criticism is around the fact that despite us having very clear and convincing evidence that well-prepared teachers can make a difference with all children, regardless of where they start, we seemingly are not interested in or don't seem to have the will to place well-prepared teachers in all classrooms with all children. So the challenge isn't to find individual teachers and or school districts that are doing well, because we have those. The challenge is to replicate that consistently across all communities.
Anybody else on this panel want to try it? So far, I've heard that there is no school district in the U.S. that's doing a good job, that you can find a teacher now and then, and sometimes a bunch of them, but there is no system that's worth writing home about. And that's the trouble. We got to figure out what's the system we want before we can go get it.
Well, first of all, I just have to say that's not true.
If there's somebody doing a good job, point them out.
All right, contact me. I'll give you some examples.
Okay, but I, you know, a teacher I can find. I know a bunch of good teachers. I'd like to see a good administrative system that encourages the education of people with disabilities. So far, I haven't found it. And if I'm supposed to help build one, I got to know what it looks like.
I agree.
Okay, I've asked my questions. What you got? Anybody have questions?
Hi, conference is over.
Identify yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Adrian Alvarez. I am from Washington, D.C. One of the things that we're seeing in D.C. is the provision of mental health services through school-based community centers. And on the one hand, you know, I think it could be a good idea in theory in that the mental health services are provided within the school, within the community. They're often provided in the native language of the student in areas where there's a high Spanish-speaking or other population. But on the other hand, it kind of takes away the responsibility of the LEA to provide those services, and especially when those services are not consistent, you're not able to hold the health center responsible the way you are an LEA who's not providing consistent or appropriate services. So I'm just wondering, you know, if, you know, community-based or school-based community health centers is something that you guys have looked at, or if, you know, if you guys have a take on that.
Who wants to tackle it?
Well, I'll start. I agree with you that the LEAs are then off the hook, and you can't compel them. They are responsible for that portion of a student's education. I mean, you just look at what happened in Florida and how that person was either not identified or not helped by the school system. I mean, they knew that they had a problem with him, and it was easier to expel him than anything else. I think that when you look at trauma-informed practices, those sorts of things need to be in our local school systems. It should be part of the responsibility, is part of the responsibility of a local education agency to ensure that a child is evaluated or assessed in all areas of suspected disability, including mental health.
I couldn't agree more.
Pardon?
I said I couldn't agree more.
Okay.
Okay. Melon Sademan, I have a couple of, I guess, points or questions. I guess one, on Ruth's point about most of these cases being tuition reimbursement cases, I think that one problem is the public interest community has often abandoned special education cases, saying there's a private bar for special ed because there are attorney's fees. And therefore, most of these cases are being brought by private attorneys who are being paid by parents, and parents pay private attorneys when they think it's going to be financially advantageous to them. And if you have a tuition payment of hundreds of thousands of dollars, then it's worthwhile to hire a lawyer. So many people, even middle class, and will not hire a lawyer because it costs them money. And I think that if the public interest community had more support for special education litigation, that would be really beneficial, because the way it works, the dynamics of the cases, is that the parents who bring these cases are parents for whom it's worthwhile to spend $20,000 or $30,000 or more on a hearing out of pocket. And I guess my second point is on what Dr. Maurer asked. Some of the great schools that provide wonderful education for kids with disabilities are not public schools. They're Montessori schools and other schools that are really designed with individualized instruction. And some of the cases, the private placement cases that have been brought by Judy Grant and others committed to inclusion, have been to get funding for those kinds of schools. And one of the problems the public schools have is the lack of funding, because, you know, it's easier in a Montessori school with 15 kids in the classroom to do inclusion than in a public school classroom in an inner city with 30 or 40 students. And so I guess those were my 2 points.
If I could respond, especially to the first comment, in Columbus, I helped get some funding for us to have our local disability rights organization have an attorney embedded in the organization whose job it is just to go to IEP meetings, not to litigate, but just to attend IEP meetings. And not always for low-income families, but for many, oftentimes for low-income families. And it's my firm belief that public organizations and others need to do a better job of helping parents have advocates at these meetings. That's very unrealistic to expect parents as non-experts to attend these meetings and advocate for their child, in that, in my experience, in the advocacy I do on a volunteer basis, just the fact that I walk into the room changes the dynamic and the result. I can keep my mouth shut, but the school district knows what they should be doing, but they get away with egregious practices because no one's watching. So I don't think litigation is really the answer, because if you have to litigate, you've lost, because years will pass before you get a legal result. But if you can achieve a good answer at that IEP meeting, it has a profound effect on the child. It doesn't take a huge time commitment to achieve that good result at an IEP meeting. So I wish more law schools around the country, education departments around the country, would be training their students to do volunteer advocacy at IEP meetings. I think that would really have a transformative effect. It's only one child at a time. It's not the structural changes I would really like, but I think it is a small thing that we each can commit to doing that can have a profound impact in a child's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with you on that, Ruth. I also think that it's very critically important for our parent resource centers, and I know they're working towards this, to be able to reach out to those parents that are most in need of the kind of advocacy services that you are describing, because oftentimes the parents that need the services the most are reluctant for any number of reasons, or may not even know that such services exist. The other comment that I would make is related to the commenters' comments regarding Montessori schools. Certainly there are a number of Montessori schools that are public schools. So part of the issue, I think, for a lot of parents still comes back to knowing the full array of options that are available to them in their local communities and being able to fully access all of the resources.
If I could just give one little anecdote to support what I was saying. I know that in various urban school districts where I live in Ohio, they schedule the IEP meetings, you know, 15 minutes apart. They know the parents aren't going to show up, that it's unrealistic for the parents to show up because of the demands on their time. And they can just count on it. And they just cut and paste from one IEP to another. They have some unbelievable statements in these IEPs that when I get a hand on them occasionally, I'm just shocked that. But no one's watching, so you can get away with it. So I think that it should be unconstitutional. This would take us someplace else, but I think it's unconstitutional for these children to not be represented at IEP meetings. It's their educational, constitutional educational rights that are being deprived when school districts just rubber stamp one IEP after another every 15 minutes often in an urban school environment. I wish we could stop that practice, but I don't know how we can do that.
You know what?
We can solve that.
Sign me up.
Maybe we could find a plaintiff somewhere. That'd be good. You know, I appreciate this. The educational system for me has been a frustration. I have tried to figure out a way to address it so that systemic change can happen. And it is a frustrating effort to do. You can win a case and it's one kid, and the system is hard to change. So we got to think of a way to do that. We are having the book. Thank you very much, panelists. You have stimulated my mind a lot this afternoon, and I'm sure you have for everybody else, so I appreciate it.